Let's read our text. It's Genesis chapter 9 this morning. And I'm actually going to start in chapter 8, verse 20, because we're going to pick up a little bit there as we go into 9. So starting in 8, verse 20, this is the covenant that God made with Noah. You may be aware of the fact that God makes certain covenants. Covenant is a fancy word for promise. It can be actually a word that we might translate today as a contract. It's God's making a deal, and his deal involves his promises. And he makes a covenant with Adam, and then he makes a covenant with Noah, and then he makes a covenant with Moses and the people of Israel, and we call that the Mosaic covenant, which is the law. Then he makes a covenant with David, King David, about a promise of a future son of his that will come and reign. And then he makes what we are more familiar with, the new covenant, which is made through his blood and pouring out of his blood, the shedding of his blood, and his death on the cross. And so there's several covenants in the Bible. This is called the Noahic covenant. So let's read from chapter 8, verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life that is its blood, and for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man, from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. And whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you. As many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you. For all future generations, I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And when I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. And when the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. And the sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. And when Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." And after the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. You might be thinking that we could have left off the last half of that chapter and just focused on the covenant, but actually, I'm more interested in the last half. I actually think the last half has more to say to us than even the first half does. And so I want to breeze through the first half of the chapter to get to the last half and talk about the significance of that passage. I want you to think for a moment, though. I think there has been a steady attack on the way we as human beings think in our world. And that steady attack is on what we trust. For example, and you can go way back, this is not just recent movies and recent culture. This, I think, goes way back in our culture, and certainly at the very beginning of what we might think of as media. We are told over and over again to trust our hearts. Trust your heart. How many times do you see that concept? It's advice that fathers give to their daughters. Trust your heart. Or to their sons. Just trust your heart on this. We hear it all the time. But you realize that is as anti-biblical of a statement as you could possibly make. In fact, the Bible says the exact opposite. It says, your heart is wicked and evil and deceitful above all things. There is actually nothing more deceitful than your own heart. And as Verlin often reminds us, with one of his favorite verses, if not his favorite verse, what does the Bible say about what we should trust? Trust in the Lord with all of your heart, and lean not on your understanding. See, I think for the first half of the 20th century, the message was, trust your heart, trust your heart, trust your heart. Well, the latter part of the 20th century into the 21st century, the media is pummeling us with the message, trust your reasoning, trust your reasoning, trust your understanding, trust the knowledge and the intelligence of the community around you. But the Bible comes along and says, these are not things that we are to trust. We are to trust the Lord with all of our heart. And this passage reminds us of why we should not trust our heart. In fact, if we take a look back at 8:20, we see the key verse that sets up the 2 points I want to talk about. And the 2 points I want to talk about is, what does God do to fix our hearts? What does God do to respond to our sinful hearts, our wicked hearts? And then I want us to really focus on the second part. What are we called to do in participating with God in responding to the wicked, sinful hearts of our brothers and sisters, our fellow human beings? And so we'll start with what God does, but first you need to see that the heart is wicked and just how wicked it is. Take a look down in verse 21. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. That should jump off the page at us, and here's why. Because if we turn back to chapter 6, we would see that this whole mess of a flood destroying the world began with a declaration. It began with this declaration, that the heart of man was evil,
and that every inclination of his heart was wicked all of the time. And consequently, that evil, wicked heart led to violence. And God said, I need to do something about this. And what he did about it was, he destroyed all of his creation except for Noah and his family and the animals that they brought on the ark. And then we come to the end of this story, and we hear what I think should have been words that just catch our breath, words that stop us in our track. And the heart of man is wicked from its youth. It tells us that the flood did not solve the problem. It tells us that God's judgment of sin and bringing about that judgment upon mankind didn't actually fix the problem. Because you see, there were 8 human beings that walked off that ark, and every last one of them actually had a wicked heart. Now, I know Noah is referred to as a righteous man, but this is our first hint that you can be declared to be righteous by God because of your faith and yet still have a wicked heart. And this story is going to sort of show us that Noah is not beyond his wicked heart. But the real issue here is man's problem has not been solved. He has a wicked heart. And God's judgment doesn't actually solve the problem of a wicked heart. So what does God do? And so let me just quickly suggest some things that God does so we can get to some things that he has called us to do and apply them to our present situation. God recognized before the flood that this wicked heart of man, in its present circumstances, in its present environment, so quickly grew more and more wicked that it filled all of the earth with violence. Violence towards animals, violence towards one another, and even, I think it's suggesting that even the animal kingdom became violent towards itself because of human beings' wickedness. He saw that happened so quickly. Let's be honest, that's kind of the point in Genesis 4 and 5. We have the fall in chapter 3, and it's like, wow, in no time at all, human beings have become so wicked, God has to destroy the earth and bring his judgment because there's nothing left for him to do. So consequently, I think what Genesis 8, 9, 10, and 11 are actually about, it's what God is going to do to keep human beings' wickedness at bay. Keep it restrained. Hold it back so we don't destroy ourselves before God can send the solution to our heart problem. God knows that he has a solution to our heart problem, and he has the perfect time when he wants to send it, in the fullness of time. The problem is, human beings will never make it to the fullness of time if God takes his hands off and lets our wicked hearts run wild. And that's what he shows in chapters 4, 5, and 6 of Genesis, that if God removes his hands and lets our wickedness just go its way, it won't take very long at all before we will destroy ourselves. And before we destroy ourselves, God has to bring judgment. So in these chapters, I think we see God laying down some things that he's going to do to restrain our evil. Let me just mention them so we can move on. One I mentioned a few weeks back. He says, you human beings cannot live to be 900 years old. Wicked people cannot live to be 900 years old. If you live that long, your wickedness will multiply. Your wickedness will increase exponentially. I am going to shorten the number of years that human beings can live. And so consequently, he very quickly brings down that number to 120 as the top end of human lifespan, because he recognized that our long lives are not to our benefit if our hearts are wicked, evil, and corrupt. So that's the first thing that he does. He does a couple of other things, though, that he mentions here. One of the things that he does here, as we see in this passage, is that he puts a reminder of his grace constantly before us. He counters our wicked heart with a reminder of grace that is always before us. He does it in a couple of ways. In one way, you notice he says, I will not curse the ground again like I have. But then he adds, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Guys, in the book of Acts, this very thing about seed time and harvest and rain, we call this common grace. This is the grace that God extends to all people, whether they know him or not. And it is meant to be a reminder that God is good, God is gracious, God is loving, God is kind. And I think he brings it up at this point because for wickedness to be restrained, human beings need to be constantly reminded of the goodness of their Creator and that their Creator loves them. Because one of our problems with our wicked human hearts is how quickly we forget. So God basically commits himself here and says, I'm going to have reminders and I'm going to constantly remind you of who I am and my love for you and my goodness and my grace that is extended to you so that your wickedness will not expand exponentially so quickly. He does another obvious reminder of his goodness and grace, right? He puts a rainbow in the sky after it rains to remind us that, I think Isaiah is the one that used this phrase, that God's judgment is his strange work. It's a great expression. That the judgment of God is his strange work. What does he mean by strange? This is God's work that doesn't come naturally to him. This is the work of God, his judgment, that is not something that he looks forward to. In fact, what God looks forward to, what comes natural to God, is to extend forgiveness, is extend his love. Judgment is something God does because he must. And it is a strange work of God. It's interesting, if you think about today and how people think about God in particular, how do they often view him? As some kind of ogre in heaven who is waiting to just bring down the hammer on anybody who acts wrong. That's how we imagine the character of God. The prophet Isaiah suggests to us, guys, that's actually an oddity in God. That's the strangeness of God's work. God's normal, consistent work that he throws himself into is the work of reconciliation and love and extending of grace. I took this from a book that I've used when I was preaching through Hosea. I used it a lot there by Dana Ortland, called Gentle and Lowly. It's worth getting, guys. This is a book. I don't recommend very many books to my congregation. You need to get the book and read it. If you want to get a good idea of the character of God, read that book, because he nails it, and he brings this point out. That it's not that God is not a just God. It is not that God does not bring judgment. But that's not what he's longing to do. That's not what he's looking forward to do. That's not what if we could say it this way, that's not what God lives for. God lives to extend his grace. And this passage in many, many places reminds us of God's grace being extended on a regular basis. And he does it to restrain evil. The next thing that he does, I think, to restrain evil is he makes living a little easier. After he cursed the ground in Genesis chapter 3, it becomes apparent that that ground was very, very difficult to produce food from. And in fact, if you notice, you can see it keep coming up in those first few chapters about how human beings have to toil so hard to gain even a little bit of food from the ground. And Noah's name, remember when Noah was named, if you turn back for just a second into chapter 5, you'll see that Lamech lived after he fathered Noah. Let me go before that. When Lamech, verse 28, when Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief. That's what his name means. His name actually means rest. And so the idea is he's going to bring rest to the ground. Well, this is what we see being fulfilled in chapter 8. That God says, you know what? I'm going to give the ground a break. And I'm going to bring a measure of rest to the ground. Now, the curse isn't entirely removed. And just to help you see that even in the text, it's actually two different Hebrew words used. And in Genesis 3, he uses a Hebrew word for cursed that actually means that it brings disastrous circumstances upon the ground. Where here, he says, he uses a Hebrew word that I will not show contempt towards the ground. And I think what he's getting at is, it's not that the curse from Genesis 3 is completely removed, but it's not going to affect human beings with the vigor and contempt that it had prior to the flood. And what we see is that Noah will bring in a time where the ground begins to produce more. Now you think, what does that have to do with restraining evil? Guys, if you have a human population and they're filled with wicked, evil people, and they begin to multiply, and they begin to multiply and they fill an earth that cannot produce the food to take care of them. Guys, if they have wicked, evil hearts, what's that going to lead to? All you have to do is look at an animal kingdom. Why does a tomcat, a mountain lion, why does the tomcat kill the male cubs, his own male cubs? Because he doesn't want to compete against them for food. Because in his area, there's a limited amount of food for him. And so consequently, he sees the male cub, his own male cubs, as a threat to his food source. Look how quickly he turns violent. That's part of the fall. I don't think that's the way God created it. I don't think God created, you know, male mountain lions killing their cubs. That's a part of the fall. That came from our sin. That's the violence that, and here's the reality. We're the first ones to do that kind of thing. It wasn't animals. I think we did it first. We're the first ones that we're ready to kill anything if it's going to protect our means of survival. So one of the things God did to restrain evil was actually make it easier for human beings to find food, which you notice in chapter 9. What's the second thing that he did? He lifted a restriction. He said, I'm going to allow you to hunt. I'm going to allow you to kill animals for food, for the purpose of eating. Why is that? Because it reduces the impact of the curse. It reduces the impact of what's making it challenging for human beings to survive. Why is he doing this? Because these are the kinds of things that led to violence before the flood. So this is the next thing God does to restrain it. Is that all he does? Actually, no, he does a few other things. Notice what he says. Remember, before the flood, we have Cain killing Abel. Now, it is clear from the story of Cain killing Abel. In fact, I would argue it's clear from the next story of Lamech killing a young man who wounded him, that God had already written on the hearts of human beings a law. And that law was, thou shalt not kill. I think it's clear. I think Cain absolutely knew what he was doing was wrong. And in fact, I think God warns him even before he does it. You know this is wrong. Sin is crouching at your door. This is not about God introducing the law upon a heart. I first thought that's what was going on in chapter 9, but I realized, no, this law is already there. God is not restraining human beings by writing a law on their heart. We already had, we're created with the law written on our heart, a conscience, that we can sear, that we can not listen to, that we can suppress because of our wicked, evil hearts. So what is God doing here? What God is doing here is instituting government in a strange sort of way. Notice what he says. He says, and for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. Remember, when Cain killed Abel, the only reckoning there was he was banished to wander the earth. That was the reckoning. And he was banished from the presence of God. Now, let's get something straight. Guys, there is no greater punishment than that. There is no greater punishment than to be banished from the presence of God. In fact, as we Christians talk about it theologically, we have a word for it. It's called hell. Hell is the place where you're banished from the presence of God. So there's no greater threat or danger to people than if you do this, this will happen. So if you thought that there was something that could restrain evil, then one of the things we would think that would restrain evil is, well, let's tell them about hell. Let's tell them about being banished from the presence of God. You know, I grew up in a fundamentalist Baptist church, and this was our approach, man. Our approach with Christians, it was our approach with non-Christians. You want to motivate them to act rightly? You want to suppress the wicked, evil heart? You preach hell, fire, and brimstone. I don't know how many of you guys get the paper, but one of our pastors in town recently wrote an article in our paper chastising the rest of us pastors for not preaching fire and brimstone enough. Now, I think we need to preach fire and brimstone. I think you need to let people know that the greatest penalty for ignoring that law that God has written on your heart is to be banished from the presence of God. But here's the problem with that. And this would be my response to that pastor. You can preach fire and brimstone all you want to the people of Deer Lodge, but if they do not have the Spirit of God in their heart is wicked and deceitful beyond belief. And I have 6,000 or more years of history to prove the point that the threat of being banished from the presence of God has done little to nothing to motivate right actions amongst those people. It is not until the Spirit of God does a work in our heart that that threat to be banished from the presence of the God who created us has any impact on us. So what is God doing here? Oh no, that was the threat before. Now he's going to give a new threat. He says, and for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of a man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made him in his own image. Well, we could say that God is instituting a new law here. It's called a life for a life. It is that, you know, if you do this, the same will happen to you. But what God is doing here is actually, by one line, he says, by man, your life will be reckoned. So what he's saying is, if I kill someone, you will be put to death. But not just put to death. He isn't saying, if you ignore my law and break my law, I will put you to death. If you kill someone, I will put you to death. To restrain our wickedness, because apparently God is suggesting that our evil, wicked hearts lead to murder quite rapidly. It leads to murder quite rapidly. And he's saying, I'm going to restrain that by saying, if you do that, then you will be put to death. But he didn't say, I'll put you to death. What does he say? By man, your life will be reckoned to. In other words, I am giving authority for human beings to act in my place as the bringer of justice to this situation. This is actually the instituting of government. If you go to Romans chapter 13 or 1 Peter, he speaks of governments being his hand of bringing punishment and justice to the people they govern. But it's God's justice that they're bringing. And that's what he's saying here. I'm setting forth a law. If you violate this law, then I am calling upon your fellow human beings to hold you accountable. And if you take a life, your life will be taken. Why is he doing this here? Well, one could say because grace didn't work. He gave grace to Cain, and human beings became more murderous. He gave grace to Lamech, and they became even more violent and murderous. So now God says, I'll give you law. And I'll give people the opportunity to extend my justice through their hands towards those who disregard the law that I have written on your heart. Remember who's writing this. Moses is writing this. Remember when he's writing it. I think it's really key behind why he's telling this story. Moses is about to give the law of God written to the people of Israel. And he's really telling them a couple of things. God is going to give us a law, and it's a great gift. And here's why it's a great gift. Because your hearts are wicked beyond belief. And they are so deceitful. In fact, if you want proof of it, by the time I get off this mountain, you will have forgotten Yahweh and you will be worshiping a golden calf. And you will be committing all kinds of sexual immorality, just like the Canaanites and the Egyptians that surround you, as an act of worship towards that golden calf. If you want proof of how wicked your hearts are. So one of the things I think Moses is trying to get across is, you know what, just because God has elected you, you know what, he elected Noah. Just because God showed his favor towards you, maybe even sees you as righteous. He said Noah was righteous, and God chose him. But that doesn't mean Noah didn't have a wicked heart, and so do you. And as a result, you need law. And you need a body of people, a governing body of people that will enact the punishments of God upon you when you break that law. And why is that? Because it will save you from your sins? Because it will change your heart? No, it will not. The law will not save anyone and it'll change no one's heart. So why give it? Because it's the only thing that's going to keep you alive long enough for me to send my son and change your heart. You need this because if I don't give it to you, you will destroy yourselves before Jesus in the fullness of time can come and deliver you from your wicked heart. This is what I think is going on in chapter 9. And this is what God does. And he does it in several other ways that I'm not going to mention because I'm out of time. And I want to get to the second part. So what do we do? That's how God responds to sin. Now ultimately we'll see that God's ultimate response to sin is to atone for it, to cover it, to send his son to bring covering. But we see a picture of that in how he calls us to respond to the sin in one another. Let's begin with Noah back in verse 20 of chapter 8. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord. When Noah came out of the ark, the first thing he did was he built an altar. And immediately he offered up an incredible number of sacrifices. I don't know how many. Every clean animal, some from every clean animal. That would be a huge number of sacrifices. It would have taken days. It might have taken weeks to offer up those kinds of sacrifices. Why is he doing this? Well, there's a couple things going on. Some would suggest that these are offerings of thanksgiving. This is a way that Noah shows thanksgiving for God for saving him. Even if that's the case, I would argue that if Noah feels like that he has to offer up life burnt offerings, life sacrifices, these animals as burnt offerings, in an offering because of thanking God for what he's done, clearly Noah is also recognizing that he and his family did not deserve to be saved. That he, in fact, was not different from those who perished in the judgment. And that his children and their wives and his wife were not fundamentally different from those who perished in the flood. So consequently, Noah is offering up a sacrifice because he sees that he is a sinner and that his family is a sinner, and that, as the text tells us, he recognizes the wickedness in his heart. Let me just speculate for a moment, but one that I think you'll find very easy to believe. Noah may have gone into that ark thinking he was righteous. And Noah's family might have gone into that ark feeling pretty righteous about themselves, looking at all those wicked people that they were standing against for 120 years and watching their behavior. But something tells me that if you take a father and his three sons and their three wives and his wife, and you stick them in a box, and you keep them there for 365 days locked up, it's not going to take that long before they figure out we're wicked too. Something tells me they may not have got along all that great in that circumstance. Something tells me that that kind of living experience would have resulted with, wow, I want to kill that guy. And then they realized, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with my heart? That's why when they come out of the ark, so quickly the declaration is made, well, the heart of man is evil from its youth. Nothing has changed. So consequently, I think Noah realizes right away, we got to offer up a sacrifice. Because God saved us. I thought he was saving us because we are better than everybody. But now I can see that's not the case. He saved us because of his good grace extended towards us. And so he offers up an offering of thanksgiving. So that's the first thing. How do we respond to other people's sins? Well, the first thing that we do is we have to recognize that we are no better. That we are equally a sinner with all of the people we look around and say, look at the sins that they're committing. That like Noah, all we would need is the right circumstance and God's hands off our lives, his grace pulled back even a little bit, and we would see that our heart is as wicked as theirs and as deceitful as theirs, and we would be doing all the things that they are doing. So the first way we respond is we see their sin in perspective. And their sin in perspective is, wow, God's grace is the only thing restraining me from doing that very kind of thing. It's that constant reminder of God's grace. It's the fact that God put me maybe in a family or in a nation or in a place where his laws are being enacted and people are being punished. And the fear of that punishment may restrain me somewhat, but other than that, I'm just like that person. I'm no different than that person. Now we come to the second half of this story, and we see other ways in which we should and should not respond. And this is where I wanted to camp a little bit and make some application. What a weird story, isn't it? Noah goes forth, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham's son Canaan is mentioned. Notice the order, Shem, Ham, Japheth. You would think, when I give a listing of my kids, it's usually going to be Ethan, Anthony, Olivia, and Amelia. How did I just do that? It's the order of their birth. Well, guys, the Bible's like that. That's not what happened here. And in fact, often the Bible isn't like that. We think it's like that. Their culture was like that. Often the Bible doesn't do that. And we should pay attention. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Well, here's what I know. Ham is the youngest. It says Ham was his youngest son. Japheth is actually younger than Shem. So the real order here should be Shem, Japheth, and Ham. So why did he say Shem, Ham, and Japheth? And then why did he say Ham's son, Canaan? Because when we get into chapter 10, you will see that Canaan was Ham's youngest son. He has four sons, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Canaan's the youngest. So why is Canaan mentioned here? Well, part of what's going on here is Moses is telling the story. Now, you might have thought he would have been interested in his son Egypt, but he really isn't because Moses is not looking back. The people of Israel may have been looking back to Egypt, but that's not the way Moses is looking. Moses is looking forward. And what is Moses looking forward to? He's looking forward to the land of Canaan. He's looking forward to the promised land. And for them to take the promised land, it's the Canaanites they're going to be dealing with. So Moses is not interested in Ham's son, Egypt. He's interested in Ham's son, Canaan. And so consequently, when he tells this story, he moves Ham right up next to Shem. Because Shem is the father of the Israelites. And Moses wants to tell this story because it's a warning to his people. It's a warning to his people how they should respond to the sins of the people around them. How they should respond to the sins in their own camp and the sins of the people, the Canaanites, in fact, around them. How should they respond? And he uses these names because these are the ones they're going to deal with. So he immediately brings Ham to the forefront and then mentions, let's bring Canaan to the forefront because it's really Canaan that we're going to be dealing with. And then in verse 19, he says, these three were the sons of Noah, and from these the peoples of the whole earth were dispersed. And Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. And he drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. Now, we can make all kinds of arguments. Is Noah sinning here? Or did he just get caught off guard? Is he like the first person that came up with viticulture? And that by planting this, he had no idea what this wine would do. The text does not present it that way. I know that there's some Jewish rabbis that because they want to protect Noah's righteousness, they argue that he's completely innocent here. But it seems to me that the text is underscoring Noah's shame and that he's not innocent. Otherwise, the actions of Shem and Japheth will not be so noble. The actions of Shem and Japheth are noble because of the fact their father is not innocent. And so consequently, I just want us to keep in mind here that whatever's going on here, Noah, because of his drunkenness, is demonstrated he's not perfectly righteous. He's a righteous man who has fallen, at least in this moment and in this way. And when, in other words, Noah has sinned, how do we respond to it? How do we respond when righteous people fail? When God's people sin? When God's creation, these human beings that he created to be image bearers of him, how do we respond when they fall and are not image bearers? What is our knee-jerk reaction to that? We have two examples right here. The first one comes from Ham. How did Ham respond? It seems peculiar, but I don't think it's that peculiar. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. What's the big deal? What's the big deal? In fact, this has caused so many problems throughout the ages that there are countless explanations of what Ham, in fact, did to Noah, all of which are far more depraved than what they think is going on in the text. Maybe one of those things happened. But kind of like going back to Cain, guys, there's no worse punishment than being banished from the presence of God, even if human beings can't recognize that. If they think having their life taken is a bad punishment, they're sadly mistaken. If they think that's worse than being banished from God's presence, they're sadly mistaken. Let me say something here. If they think some gross sexual sin is a worse sin than what Ham does just on the surface of this text, they're mistaken. Because this is what he did on the surface of the text. His father fell. His righteous father fell into sin and was exposed. He laid naked before everyone so all could see his sin. And Ham reveled in it. He revels in it so much that he doesn't do a thing about it, but goes and tells his, "You should see Dad. What a despicable sight he is." Ham delighted in the sin of a righteous man. He delighted in his failure to be the image bearer of God. Guys, that's a pretty bad sin. In fact, let me give you an example of Ham. Ham is a type. I know another man, not by his own actions, but by his own choice, was uncovered before all of humanity, was bared naked, hanging on a cross, when he became the shame and the sin that we placed upon him. Ham was there. Ham was at that cross. Ham was the people at the cross that were mocking Jesus and laughing and delighting in that shameful spectacle of one who claimed to be the Messiah hanging on a Roman cross dying. That's Ham. I don't think we need to make Ham sin any worse than what the text does right on the surface. He is delighting in the downfall of a righteous, just as those people were delighting in what they believed to be the downfall of a righteous man. They were wrong, but they thought it was the downfall. Now, ask yourself this question, why? Why do people delight in the downfall of righteous people? Then ask yourself, do you ever delight in the downfall of righteous people? Why do we delight in that? Simple. Because it makes us feel better. It makes us feel more righteous. If Ham was struggling If Ham was already acting in ways that were not righteous in the eyes of God, his father was a constant reminder of his failing what God had called Ham to be. So consequently, if that was going on, which is pretty believable that something like that could be going on, for Noah to fall and for Noah to sin, Ham can feel better about himself. And he can delight in it because now he does what we often do. Oh, I'm not so bad. How can I think of myself as being so bad? Look at these preachers and what they do. I never even go to church. I wouldn't dream of doing to my wife what these preachers have done to theirs. Wouldn't even dream of it. What are we doing there? What we're doing is we're delighting in their failure because it makes me feel better about my falling short of what God has called me to. That's Ham. That's what Ham does. And that's what brings about a curse upon him. Now, I want you to see the other two, because they're great. The other two are a type. They're a type of Jesus. They're a type of God. And they're a type of Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. Look what they do. They cover their father. They don't delight in their father's failure. They take a garment. In fact, it's strange. It doesn't say it's Noah's garment. It's referred to as the garment. It uses an article there, and it's just a weird way of saying it. The garment. They took the garment, and they walked backwards into the room. And I got to be careful here, or I'll fall off the stairs. And they walk backwards, and they place it over him without looking at him, and cover his shame. What a great picture. And here's why it's such a great picture. Because the word for atonement in Old Testament is the word to cover. To cover is the way the Jews spoke about our sins. Remember what David says in one of his famous Psalms. Blessed is the man whose sins are forgiven. And whose transgressions are forgiven. And whose sins are covered. His sins are covered. This is the word for atonement. They use that same Hebrew word for cover. Let's go back a couple of chapters. Remember Genesis 3? Adam and Eve sin. And the first thing that happens when they sin was what? Oops, I'm naked. They realized they were naked. And they were ashamed. Now, we progressed because Noah seems to be naked and unashamed. But his kids, Shem and Japheth, recognize their shame there, and they're going to cover that shame. But Adam and Eve recognized they were naked and they're ashamed. So when God came in the cool of the day, they hid from him. And when they finally get cornered, and God says, why are you hiding? Well, we were ashamed. We were naked and ashamed. Who told you you were naked? Did you eat from that tree that I told you not to eat from? Well, of course they had. And how did God deal with their sin? He killed an animal and took its skin and made a garment and covered them. It was symbolic. God dealt with Adam's and Eve's sin by covering their nakedness, the shame that it brought to their lives, with a garment. Now we have two men. It's not a garden, it's a vineyard. Another fruit who brings the fall of a righteous man, Noah, not Adam. And now we have two men, Shem and Japheth, acting like God, covering with a garment their father's sin. What a beautiful picture of what God has called all of us to do for one another when we sin. I'll come back to that for a moment, but let's see the type. Let's see the picture. Is something going on here? Because how is our sin dealt with? God covers it. In fact, if you go all the way to the end of the Bible, you will realize that there is a garment waiting for you. There is a robe of righteousness as white can be, that God will cloak over your naked body and cover your shame forever and ever. So the book starts with somebody putting a garment on someone, covering their shame, and it ends that way. There's probably something significant to it. So what we see is a picture of two men bearing the image of God, covering their father's shame. Let's talk about application for a moment. Obviously, on the one side, we learn what we don't do. Guys, we got to stop delighting in the sins of people, especially people we don't like. We got to stop delighting in that. We got to stop delighting when the hypocrite is exposed because, I knew he was a hypocrite. Look what he's really like. We should be brokenhearted when even that person that we suspected was hypocritical because he was arrogant or whatever it may be, we should be brokenhearted when we discover what sins were lying underneath the surface that were being hidden. We should never delight in the sins of other people, especially the righteous. But we should delight in the sins of those who have rejected God. Because all we're doing there is falsely convincing ourselves that we are more righteous than we are. So that's on the one side. The second side is even more difficult, but more important. We need to cover one another's shamefulness. When we sin, or when someone in our community sins, somebody in our family sins, not only should we be brokenhearted about the shamefulness it exposes, we should act like God acts. We should participate with God in bringing a covering to that sin. Well, how do you do that? What are we supposed to do? Have garments and bring them around and put garments on people? Well, one of the things that I think we do to help cover that, we bring the message of the gospel, a message of forgiveness, a message that God will cover their sins. We participate in God's covering of their sins by proclaiming that good news to those people. But I think there are other things that we do. We don't go around gossiping with one another as Ham did, I might add, because if you want to see the first act of gossip, you have it right there. Have you seen Dad? Instead of acting on behalf of his dad and covering the shame, he just goes out and tells other people. We can't be doing that. So what do we do? Well, we, in the most respectful way we possibly can, in this story, backs turned to Noah, walking backwards into his room. Seems kind of like a crazy thing, but it illustrates that when we come and we try to bring a covering for our fellow human beings' sin, we should act in such a way that we are not in any way making their shame greater. They don't need any more shame. So let me disagree with my fellow pastor. I don't think it is my job to raise the shame level of the people of Deer Lodge. It's my job to act as God does and proclaim forgiveness to those who will respond. It is my job to very respectfully, without pointing out how horrible a people they are, because they're no more horrible than I am, to walk backwards towards them, bringing the good news of the gospel, to maintain as little shame as I possibly can, even as I bring an offering of something to cover it. That's what God has called us to do as Christians. We don't ignore judgment. We don't ignore sin. We don't ignore the shame that comes with that sin. But it is also not our job to delight in it, expose it, magnify it, shine a light upon it, without actually addressing it as God addressed it for us, with self-sacrificing love. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for this passage and just its reminder to us that there is a way to respond to the sins in our own life and in the sins in other people's lives. And I just pray that we can become Shems and Japheths in this story, that we will have this kind of honor for our Father. I don't know what Moses was doing, but I'm suspicious, Lord, that at this very time he is writing Genesis, he's also writing, honor your father and mother, for you will live long in the land. And Shem and Japheth honored their father, and Ham did not. And the Canaanites were about to be banished from the land, because they apparently learned from their father
not to honor their father. Lord, I pray that we can be a people that we not only honor our fathers in this way, but we honor one another by being your instrument of bringing the covering of shame, the covering of guilt, the covering of sin, by proclaiming the good news to those in our community. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.